Students on our tours always ask us how we know so much, and mostly it's that we read a lot. We had to delay recording the episode about Mary Myers because a new book about her came out the day before we had planned to record, and Dan had to read it first. In fact, for all of the episodes of Tour Guide Tell All, there are a few books that we've all read about the topic already. And in my case, sometimes we wrote the book. So we thought we'd just bring you guys into the club, the Tour Guide Tell All Book Club. We're still working out the details because we literally came up with this idea while recording this. Each week, we are giving a shout out to a local business or organization making DC a better, safer, happier, and more educated place. This week, we wanted to highlight Mahogany Books in Anacostia and Loyalty Books in Silver Spring. Now, both have brick-and-mortar stores, but you can also order from them online. Mahogany Books focuses on books written for, by, and about people of the African diaspora. Loyalty Books was founded by a Black and queer bookseller who has spent her career working to diversify the book industry. In visiting their websites to, you know, make sure we give you the right web address, Rebecca Factor and I both got copies of Clarence Lussain's book, The Black History of the White House. It's not a new book. It came out in 2010, so I'm embarrassed I didn't have it already. We are going to read that as soon as it's shipped out, so we decided to invite you to do the same. Both Mahogany Books and Loyalty Books have copies on their website, links in the show notes. So buy a copy from them or another independent bookseller or borrow one from your local library. Chat with us on Twitter at tourguidetell or email us tourguidetellall@gmail.com. And if you want details on joining the Tour Guide Tell All Book Club, whenever we figure that out, we'll post an update in the show notes and on social media.
Welcome back to another Tour Guide Tell All. I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Becca.
And we are
the Rebeccas.
We're the Rebeccas.
I just wanted to say that.
No, that's good. I love it. And we're here to talk to you guys today for our next installment. We're going to talk a little bit about Betsy Ross. We're going to give you the Betsy Ross experience for Flag Day. So I thought it would be good to start out and have Becca sort of play my foil. I'm going to ask Becca to tell me sort of what the popular perception of Betsy Ross is, what her ideas about who she was and sort of what the legend is of Betsy Ross. So,
absolutely. I love this. You suggested doing this topic in conjunction with Flag Day, which is so great. So just for those listening who might not be familiar, Flag Day is June 14th. It's not a big federal holiday the same way that like Memorial Day or Veterans Day is, but it's still a holiday that many communities commemorate with parades and events. And of course, the president issues a proclamation asking everyone to fly their flag. And the reason we do it on June 14th is that is when the Second Continental Congress had a resolution to adopt the flag of the United States. So ever since Woodrow Wilson sort of signs it into law as a holiday, we commemorate the flag. So there's a perfect connection between Flag Day and I think talking about Betsy Ross. So when I go back to my schoolgirl days and I think about Betsy Ross, first of all, I'll just get on my little soapbox. We get so little women's history. And I think especially when we were in school that you only talked about a handful of women. And one of them was Betsy Ross. And what kills me is we sort of learn about Betsy Ross and you think like, okay, I'm learning about this historical woman. And then you find out that like most of what you learn about her is not true. So what I remember learning was sort of this myth of this woman who is approached by George Washington, and depending on how maybe outrageous your teacher was, you know, George Washington comes racing to her house on his horse, fresh from the Continental Congress, with a design of a flag, and he says, "Betsy, will you make me this flag?" And she sews until her fingers bleed, creating the first flag. Now, I've heard versions of this myth where she designed the flag herself. I've heard versions where she's a young woman, versions where she's this old widow just desperate to do something for the country before her death. But either way, we have this idea that sort of Betsy Ross created the very first American flag. And I am pretty sure that's not accurate.
So here's the thing about Betsy Ross. Almost none of that is accurate, including her name.
Betsy Ross is just so catchy.
I know, it really is. So the thing that I think about Betsy Ross, and we're going to give, just to start out with, the spoiler alert for this is Betsy Ross is actually really way cooler, I think, than this fake flag story. So we'll get to that towards the end. But Betsy Ross is important, kind of as Becca alluded to. She is the only, and you can correct me if you can think of another one, but she's the only woman I can think of from this period who's famous in her own right. She's not Martha Washington or Abigail Adams. She's not famous because of her association with a man. She's just herself. And so that I think is really cool. Unfortunately, like most of the stories about her are not true.
I do have to jump in and say there are some great figures from this period, female figures, women like Molly Pitcher and Deborah Sampson and Sybil Ludington. And sadly, they don't get nearly as much attention as this sort of mythical story of Betsy Ross. So I hope listening to this podcast will encourage you to look maybe for some other real women from this period, because there were incredible women.
Oh, yeah.
And we tend to sort of teach this legend instead, which can be disappointing.
Betsy Ross should not be, like, that was not my point. She should not be the most famous woman from this period, but she is. And so kind of we have to roll with what we got, I guess. And we can have a separate conversation about how women have been sort of shunted to the side in this period. But Betsy Ross is not her name. She is, like Becca alluded to, variously depicted as this young, beautiful girl, or like Mrs. Claus. Like, she's either really grandma or like 20 years old.
And nothing in between.
Nothing in between, because middle-aged women apparently don't count. She is young. So the grandma issue of Betsy Ross, we can like dispense with that one immediately. It's also not the house that we have that is in Philadelphia that we actually take people to on our tours in Philadelphia may or may not actually be her house. Her profession is incorrect. And we'll start with her name. So she's born Elizabeth Griscom in 1752. She's actually born on January 1st. She was the eighth of 17 children. And let's just pause for a moment on 17 kids.
Oh boy.
Okay, deep breaths, everyone. She's born to a Quaker family. She actually is born in New Jersey on her family farm, and they move to Philadelphia at some point when she's a young kid. She gets apprenticed as an 11-year-old girl to an upholsterer named William Webster. And in the sort of legend about Betsy Ross, she's a seamstress, which is not true. A seamstress is a more female-oriented activity. It involves sewing, and it's very difficult and requires a lot of skill. But upholsterer, and this is what she trains to be, is much more broad. Upholstery is going to involve furniture. It does involve sewing, but some upholsterers are like proto-interior designers. It's a more male-dominated profession. So her parents, because of their sort of Quaker upbringing, they seem to want Betsy to get involved in a more male-oriented profession. So we're already doing her a disservice, sort of shunting her off as a seamstress. She was an upholsterer.
It's fascinating that she comes from a Quaker background. This is something that I feel like I've become more and more aware of in the last few years, doing a lot more research on women's history, but that because of sort of the Quaker ideals of egalitarianism and this inclusion, that they often were less hesitant about women entering into male-dominated fields. They were more likely to believe that women should be educated, more likely to encourage women to seek education and to be productive members of society, including seeking employment. So it's sort of fascinating, but not surprising, given what I now sort of know about the Quaker faith, particularly in this period, that she would have that background, and that's why she kind of ends up where she does.
Right. It is kind of interesting to me as well. While she is apprenticed to William Webster, she falls in love with a fellow apprentice named John Ross. And little note about Betsy, she has three husbands. They're all named John, which must have been pretty convenient, actually. John Ross is not a Quaker. His father's actually a minister. His uncle, a few years later, his uncle George will be one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. So he's pretty high up in sort of what was called the Church of England at that time, and is now the Episcopal hierarchy. His father is actually the rector at Christ Church in Philadelphia, which is this beautiful old very historic church that's still there and is absolutely beautiful. At any rate, they fall in love and they decide they want to get married. But the Quakers, Betsy's family really isn't too keen on her marrying outside of her Quaker faith. And so she and John Ross actually elope. So there's like a little intrigue there. When she's 21 years old, they run away and get married. And so she's no longer a Quaker. She actually worships at Christ Church in Philadelphia. And while she's worshiping at Christ Church, she actually meets a lot of sort of prominent founding fathers. For example, George Washington. He is a member of Christ Church in our area, in Alexandria. And so while he's in Philadelphia for his various like founding father goings on, he worships at Christ Church. And there is evidence that they knew each other. He actually is going to employ her later on. We have evidence of that because George Washington took meticulous notes about everything.
Especially when it came to spending his money.
Oh yeah, big time. So they start their own business and things are really, really great. They get married in 1773 and the marriage doesn't last that long. 2 years later in 1775, we're ramping up towards the American Revolution and John Ross is involved, her husband is involved in the local provincial militia. And as such, he is appointed to guard the munitions depot, so like sort of munitions dump. And he dies in 1775. The family story is while guarding the munitions dump, there is a fire and he gets caught in the fire. Back then, like they would put a lot of gunpowder in the same place. That mixed with the oil lamps and the open flames of the day doesn't really seem to end well for John Ross. So she's 24 years old. She's been married for a little over 2 years and now she's a widow. She gets married again 2 years later, 1777, to a mariner named Joseph Ashburn. He is away for a lot of their marriage, but they do manage to have two daughters, Zillah and Eliza. Zillah does not live very long. She dies at 9 months, but Eliza grows up to be an adult. And Ashburn is captured at sea. So we're in the midst, this is 1777, we're in the midst of the American Revolution. She's has her upholstery business, her husband's been captured, and they don't like have Twitter back then. So she doesn't like know this is going on. Word takes a while to get to her. She eventually hears that he has been imprisoned. He gets captured by the British, so they bring him to England and imprison him. And prison conditions aren't super great back then, especially for traitors like the Americans were. And so Ashburn dies in prison in 1782. So in 1782, she's not even 30. She's outlived two husbands and one child. And here's where her story gets a little bit interesting, I think. Ashburn has a friend, John Claypool, who is with him in prison. John Claypool gets out of prison, comes home to Philadelphia, and has the unfortunate task of informing Betsy Ross, or well, Betsy Ashburn at this point, that her husband has died in prison. So he brings the bad news of her husband's death to her, and then something strange kind of happens there because she marries him a year later. So he brings the news of her husband's death and then he totally hits that and they get married. So I'm going to leave you to draw your own conclusions on that one, but I'm just saying the dude must have had something going on because that is not news that I would recover from pretty easily. And she like marries him a year later. So Claypool.
I don't know. It's the war. Men her age are probably dying left and right. She probably figured you got to lock one down while you can.
It's true. You need a male provider. She kind of picks badly, however. John Claypool's a good husband. They have five children. They seem to be very happy, but he is in not great health, perhaps connected to his war service. The record is kind of silent about this. At this point, after they've had two children, they move into the house that is sort of bears her name today in Philadelphia on Arch Street. And they have a total of five daughters together. Yeah, so she's now got six daughters. She maintains a very successful upholstery business, makes herself a pretty, not wealthy, but certainly comfortable living for the rest of her life. She moves into sort of solid middle class. The house is very, in Philadelphia to this day, is very sort of standard middle-class home for its time. She raises all her children that live, and she eventually is going to go blind in her sort of old age. She outlives all of her husbands and eventually dies in 1836 at the age of 84.
It's incredible. Now, for that period.
It really is incredible. And the things about Betsy Ross that are kind of interesting to me, first of all, she was not really known as Betsy Ross that long. Betsy was a nickname. It was what her family called her. All the official sort of George Washington refers to her as Elizabeth. Any sort of official like work-related documents, she's known as Elizabeth. So Betsy is actually incorrect. She also was known for most of her life as Elizabeth Claypool. That's her last husband, the one she's married to the longest. That's what her business name is. So Betsy Ross is really Elizabeth Claypool for anyone who's interested. She is, however, the Widow Ross. When in 1776, when George Washington definitely does not come to her house and does not ask her to make the first American flag. So 1776, she is the Widow Ross, and that's why she's come down in history as Betsy Ross. The house that she supposedly sewed the first flag, they don't purchase that until after. She didn't purchase that with John Ross at all. She purchases that with her third husband after the American Revolution. And the property records are a bit unclear. We know she lived on that side of that of Arch Street in Philadelphia, but we don't know which house it was. So it could be the garden that's sort of next door today. We actually don't know. And she's not a seamstress. She is very much an upholsterer, very skilled. She seems to have been in demand. She makes a good living. And she does make flags. That part is real.
And I have to mention, you know, it's not like she's the only lady in town who makes flags. Making flags is actually a pretty profitable endeavor, mm-hmm. particularly in Philadelphia and Boston and these East Coast cities during the war, because every militia, every regiment, every group wants a flag, and they want whatever flag George Washington has. They want the flag for their colony or their state. They want their flag for their regiment, their group. So making flags is big business during this time, and a lot of women made money making flags. Mm. So I think when they tell the story, we often think of like Betsy Ross was the only gal in town with a needle and thread, but a lot of people were doing it. In fact, one little fun connection for me in this story is there was another flag maker in Philadelphia named Rebecca Young, who made a lot of the flags for the different regiments and whatnot. And her daughter would be Mary Young Pickersgill, who would go on to make the Star Spangled Banner during the War of 1812. And we'll have to do a whole separate podcast on Mary Pickersgill, who I find really interesting, and the Star Spangled Banner. But I just like to mention that making flags was big business in this time, because you couldn't just go online and order them. Someone had to make them. And these were all new. That we were new. We were a new country. People had new designs. And that's also why it's so hard to pin down where some of these flag design elements come from, because different people were commissioning different flags from different places.
Yes. So Betsy Ross does make many flags. She gets a commission from the Pennsylvania Fleet to make flags for the fleet in 1777. We know that she knew George Washington. We know that we have several records of him paying her to make bed hangings and bed linens and furniture, things like that, for Mount Vernon. So they knew each other. They were in contact. But the other part of this sort of legend of George Washington coming to her house, he wasn't in Philadelphia in 1776. He wasn't there. There's a reason he didn't sign the Declaration of Independence, and it's because he wasn't there. He was fighting the war already. So like both sides of this are completely wrong. But she does. She is very well regarded and well respected. She's not the only flag maker in Philadelphia. She's not the only flag maker in the brand new United States. Everybody's kind of making flags. And the idea that sort of the American flag springs forth from Betsy Ross's head completely perfect is also incorrect. We didn't actually settle on a design for the American flag until well after we were already a country. There were a bunch of different flags, different state flags. And so she did make flags, but she didn't invent the American flag. Like, that isn't her idea. So the question, of course, is why do we believe that she did? Like, where does this all come from? Not from Betsy, as it turns out. She died, lived a normal life, made flags for the Pennsylvania fleet and bed linens for George Washington, and kept herself and her children afloat, and dies in 1836. And that was that for Betsy Ross. But in the early 1870s, her grandson, a man named William Canby, he kind of comes out of the woodwork, and he gives the first record of this. He gives a talk and writes a paper for the Pennsylvania Historical Society. And he does this in the ramp up to 1876. Now, Becca, what is 1876?
1876 is a big deal. It is the centennial of the United States, right? So we're 100 years old in 1876. We're also hosting the first official World's Fair in the United States in Philadelphia. So we've got a point in 1876 where our country's 100 years old. We're a couple generations removed from the founding fathers. And there's a lot of patriotism. There's a lot of excitement. And there's a lot of drive to sort of preserve our history, but also to sort of ramp up the legend of the founding of the United States. And so it makes perfect sense to me, and it's understandable that William Canby, this grandson of this woman who was there, lived through this significant era, is going to want to share her story. But what he shares is not really the truth of her story, as it were.
No. So he coincides, the 1870s and sort of our centennial is going to coincide with something that's been called the cult of the flag. This is where we're getting a lot of the sort of first stirrings of patriotism. We're going to sort of rally around, you know, our founding generation. And one of the things about America, the United States, versus some countries in Europe or other places in the world is we're really new. And so, you know, you don't really talk about the founding of England or Great Britain or Germany or even China. Like, there wasn't documentation of it, you know, but because we're so new, there is a lot of documentation. So we're in the unique position of trying to mythologize our actual history. And so there's a lot of that. And sort of the way we react to the founders doesn't necessarily come from them. It comes from people who are sort of mythologizing them afterward, like George Washington and the cherry tree and, you know, not being able to tell a lie and all that stuff. That stuff is going to be created later sort of as a reaction to mythologizing our history. And William Canby, Betsy Ross's grandson, very much takes advantage of this movement. And he presents this paper and he basically lays out the legend that Becca had laid out at the beginning of this pod. George Washington, the flag, Betsy Ross creates it, etc. And he has as proof no documentation other than him and his cousins and like his elderly, you know, aunts and uncles have sworn affidavits saying that everything he's saying is completely true. And why would they? Obviously, they wouldn't lie. It's not like they have any, you know, financial incentive to lie about all of this. So that's like literally all the documentation that they have.
And he basically points to one time that Washington went to Philadelphia in that year, one quick visit to Philadelphia, and said that had to be why he came. He came to request this flag.
Yes.
As opposed to conducting, you know, any official business, which is why he went to Philadelphia.
Right, which is why he was in Philadelphia. And it's really remarkable to me that despite no evidence, America just sort of swallows this Betsy Ross story completely wholesale. Like, we just buy into it in a huge way. And that's sort of where the legend of Betsy Ross kind of comes from. Like, three kernels of actual truth and then a whole lot of speculation and sort of romanticization. So today, like, Betsy Ross is super famous. She never lived to see any of this, but her grandson or grandchildren made a lot of money off of trying to promote her as sort of a famous American Revolutionary War figure. And the house is in Philadelphia, and it's this huge, big thing. However, my spin on Betsy Ross is this. I think we should focus on Betsy Ross for what she actually did do. Betsy Ross loses two husbands during the American Revolution. She raises her children, she gets married a third time, and raises a bunch more children. And both the American Revolution and the period immediately after, while we're trying to form our new government and trying to get started as a country, I can only imagine how difficult that must have been. Like, this isn't the smoothest sailing period in American history. And so she's raising a family, losing husbands, managing to keep sort of things together during a very difficult portion of our history. Not only does she survive, she really thrives. And so she makes something of herself. And so I think for that reason, she kind of does it on her own. Her husbands are of limited assistance in this. And so I think for that reason, Betsy Ross sort of embodies that real American spirit of, like, you know, soldiering through and figuring it out. And she's sort of represents thousands of women who have been lost to history that did the same thing, that just sort of, while their husbands were off at war, raised children, kept the family business going, that don't get a lot of credit for it. And I think that's what makes Betsy Ross kind of really awesome. And I feel like we should just reclaim her, like, take, you know, strip away this bogus flag story idea and talk about how Betsy Ross really is a great stand-in for so many other women who survived and thrived during a difficult time.
Well, she's such an entrepreneur, and that's the part of the story I find so fascinating, that she built such a successful business, that she was able to work for so long. You know, she adapts her business as the war comes and there's flag work. She starts making flags, even though she's not trained as a flag maker. She's trained as an upholsterer. Mm-hmm. And I find that kind of spirit of adaptability really fascinating. And I think you're right. I think she represents so many women of this era. We tend to think about women during the American Revolution, during the founding period, in very limited ways, either sort of these wives who are helping great men do great things, or these, you know, very sweet women at home sort of waiting for things to happen. And that's not the case at all across the board for many of these women. And so I love Betsy Ross. I love your idea of reclaiming her as sort of this feminist icon. I think that's really, really cool. This also does lead to a question, though, and I think it's a hard question as Americans for us to grapple with, but the question of, well, okay, so who invented the first flag? What was the first flag? This is what's so hard. We don't know. There are 17 different examples of 13-star flags that were made during the Revolutionary War that we know of that have been documented. So it's really hard to attribute the stars and stripes, the grand old flag, to any one person and any one design. And I know that's, I think, hard for Americans particularly, but hard to sort of be like, I want to say that this is the flag of George Washington, or I want to know that Betsy Ross designed it. But the truth is, like much of our country, it was sort of a collaborative effort of different flags, all sort of sharing similar elements, all coming together. And, you know, I think we always think of the Betsy Ross flag with, like, the circle of stars, but there's a lot of evidence that most of the flags that were being made at that time had the stars in rows,
yep,
like we do today, not in the circle.
There's also, like, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, Francis Hopkinson, he also claims to have invented the American flag. So they couldn't even agree back then. And there's really, like, and it's one of those things I feel like I kind of like that there's no one moment where we all, like, collectively decided. I like that it's sort of a collaborative process, that even, you know, you referenced Mary Pickersgill, and we'll talk about her at some point later, but even by that time, they hadn't completely settled on what the American flag was going to look like. Mary Pickersgill's flag, when we added states, we would add a star to the blue field and a stripe. And so that process goes on for a little while until we realize that it's not going to be a workable solution, because we keep adding states, we're going to have a really long, you know, very striped flag. So that process takes a long time, and it takes us sort of years, decades to sort of coalesce around the flag that we have today, which is why, you know, it's sort of, and again, the flag has changed as recently as the 1950s when we added Hawaii and Alaska. So it's not like it's this one static thing that's been the way that it has been since George Washington. You know, it's really kind of a, like our country, an evolving process. And so I like the idea of that as well. And like a lot of, like, popular movements, sort of fads and memes today and jokes, no one's really sure where it comes from. So there's this sort of popular element to it that really, I think, is appealing as far as the flag.
I do like, you know, Woodrow Wilson. I was saying at the beginning of the podcast, Woodrow Wilson is the president who sort of signs into law this official commemoration of Flag Day. And he was asked about the Betsy Ross legend. And in 1916, even then, Woodrow Wilson said, "Would that it were true," sort of admitting that it would be a lovely story, but we know that it's not the truth and not then. So even 100 years ago, Woodrow Wilson and when we were sort of commemorating Flag Day officially, they sort of admitted that this was not the true story, which is so fascinating that still in the 1990s, at least, it was being taught in schools.
Right. Oh, yeah. Totally true. And so the flags evolve. All flags evolve. The longest flag tradition is the British flag, but even that was changing at that time, too. Right around this time, the English forced the Scottish to sign the Act of Union, creating Great Britain. And so they changed their flag right around this same moment. So it's really kind of an evolving process, I think. And so Betsy Ross plays a part in it. And I think she should be really better known for more surviving and thriving and being a great example of what women had to do. And it's, you know, men go off and get the glory in battle. And we talk about Thomas Jefferson and we talk about John Adams, but we don't really talk about the sort of wives who are at home suffering just as much, sort of trying to make do without their providers, without what raising children, without knowing what's going to continue to happen, armies moving across the area. So I feel like we need to reclaim Betsy Ross. She's a feminist icon, and I've decided that that's going to be how it is.
I like it. I like it a lot. So typically on our podcasts and after our story, we talk about where you can maybe find this history in Washington, D.C. And sadly, there's not a lot related to Betsy Ross here because Washington, D.C. did not exist at this time. And a lot of what history does relate to her around her is in Philadelphia. You mentioned the house, which I'd be interested to know a little bit more about. The house is a national park site today, correct?
Yes.
So people can visit the house in Philadelphia when it's not a pandemic. There's some mention of Betsy Ross at the American History Smithsonian, but she's actually also featured in an exhibition on stamps at the National Postal Museum. So there is one place that you can sort of go and see a little bit of Betsy Ross history, and that's at the Postal Museum, which is one of my favorite Smithsonians. It's a little off the beaten path. It's right by Union Station as opposed to along the main stretch of the National Mall. But there was a flag issued in 1952, the 200th anniversary of Betsy Ross's birth. She had a special 3-cent stamp back then, a 3-cent stamp. And this is at a point, the 1950s, where the Betsy Ross legend was still very much alive, hadn't really come under, I think, the scrutiny for the historical accuracy that we have now. But it is, of course, as you would imagine, it's her with like George Washington and Robert Morris, and she's like presenting that iconic circular 13-star flag. But you can see that stamp on display. But otherwise, I don't think we have much Betsy Ross history in DC, unless I'm forgetting something.
My favorite part about that is that you could actually buy a stamp for 3 cents. And that would like get sent anywhere. We don't have a ton. I do want to shout out Philadelphia, though. We do, Free Tours by Foot does have a branch in Philadelphia. There's a lot of Betsy Ross history. The Quaker Meeting House she worshipped at. Christ Church, which is gorgeous. Her home, Old City Philadelphia, sort of where she would have walked around. Betsy Ross's post-life is also kind of interesting. She's buried at a cemetery and then dug up 20 years later and reburied at Mount Moriah. And then when she becomes kind of famous, they dig up what they think is her. We didn't have DNA back then. And so they dug up possibly her, possibly some random woman who was buried near her. And that person is now buried in the garden of what was her house. So there is, her grave is there as well, sort of outside her house, which is a national park site today. So there's plenty of Betsy Ross stuff in Philly, as well as a bridge that we built later and named after her.
Excellent. Well, this is, I think, the perfect companion podcast to Flag Day. So when you're listening to this, as it comes to June 14th, be sure to fly your flag, whichever flag of choice you have, whether it's the 13 star, the 50 star, maybe you've been kicking around a 51st star flag, just for funsies. But be sure to think of Betsy and her real life contributions on Flag Day this year. Now, if you're looking for more information on the podcast, you can check out our show notes. We'll have some links and information included there. You can also make sure you're subscribed to the podcast on any of your apps, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, Podcaster, Spotify, whatever you use, make sure you're subscribing. You can also be a patron of this podcast. Being a patron gives you an opportunity to get episodes early, special content. We do some special videos. You can actually watch us live stream while we record. So being a patron gives you access to a lot of cool stuff. It allows you to support the podcast and help support our tour guides until we can be back out there leading tours in person. Where else can they find the podcast or find us if they want to chat with us?
You can find us on the Twitters. We are at Tour Guide Tell. Please feel free to follow us and engage with us if you have questions or comments and want to suggest future episodes. That would be great too. You can find us on Facebook, Free Tours by Foot, DC by Foot. We have both pages. We're pretty active there as well. And the Twitters and the Facebooks, the Instagram as well. We have Free Tours by Foot Instagram. So please feel free to reach out and follow us on Spotify or Apple, on our Patreon page. We're all over the place. We like to be friendly.
We're everywhere. We are. Excellent. Well, thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Bye.
Tour Guide Tell All is Becca Grahl, Rebecca Fackner, Dan King, and Candon Arseniega. We are all tour guides with Free Tours by Foot, Washington, D.C., and we are doing all the brainstorming, recording, producing, and editing of the podcast. You can help us by becoming a patron. You get early access, special episodes, behind the scenes, and more. Find out more at patreon.com/tourguidetellall. If you have any questions or comments or ideas for future episodes, email us at tourguidetellall@gmail.com. or follow us at Tour Guide Tell on Twitter. Next episode, we delve more into Malcolm X Meridian Hill Park, where you can find a memorial to a president who, well, let's be honest, few people, then or now, thinks deserves a memorial.
Buchanan is often forgotten today, to say the least, and certainly by many historians considered one of the worst American presidents.